Hi, this is a first for me. Climb Cherno has been driving me crazy to do a series on the yard sites of famous people. It's not something I really was so comfortable with doing, but nevertheless, he's bugging me constantly, and I figure he must know what he's talking about. So I'm going to undertake to do it. Today is the yard site of the Rishash, and Chaim's been mentioning that to me for a couple of days now, so I'm going along with his entreaties. As I said, today is the 10th of Shvat, right? So it's a yard site of a very famous person that nobody's heard about, most of you. And that's the Rishash. Now, I'm not talking about the Rishash, I'm talking about the Rishash. If you're a yeshiva guy, the Rishash is the one written in the back of the Gemara, Rav Shmuel Strassman from Vilna, who has all those famous notes on the Talmud. But I'm talking about the other Rishash, who actually is more famous. That's Hisham Sharabi, but he's not so famous among the Ashkenazim and the non-Kabbalists. This is somebody who lived in the 1700s. Now, I really was not comfortable with starting to give a talk, even for a few minutes, to a general audience about a Mekubal, because what does anybody know about this sort of thing? But since I got a sign from heaven, I figured maybe somebody's trying to tell me something. You see, 2 weeks ago, I was in Teaneck, and I gave a talk there, which had to do, among other things, with a famous rabbi of yesteryear, Avraham Gershon Kotover, who was brother-in-law of the Baal Shem Tov and a chavrusa with the Nodeb Yehuda. And so happens that in the audience was my good friend Chaim Kranzler, the son of the late, great Dr. Kranzler, Mrs. Kranzler, the principal TA back in Baltimore of yesteryear. And they happen to be descended from Avraham Gershon Kotover. I know that. And I mentioned that in my talk. And he came over to me afterwards. This is strange. And he said, you know, they say that Avraham Gershon Kotover was an Ashkenazi Jew. When he came to Yerushalayim in the 1740s, he learned in the Kabbalistic yeshiva, Beit El, for a number of years. And I thought, like, to myself, why are you telling me this? That's strange. Knows why bring up that particular detail? And then, like a few days later, Chaim started telling me, talk about the Rishash, talk about the Rishash, who is Mr. Beit El in Yerushalayim. And so I'm taking this as a sign that I should proceed, since we're in the subject of spookyism and mysticism. Now, for a very audience like this, I would make just a few points and not go into whole detailed biography, because you know, I sit here for a couple hours. And I don't have a couple hours. The Rishash of Hisham Sharabi is an example of a certain type of topos, so a trope, a certain kind of story that you find popping up in Jewish history, Jewish writings from time to time, which I call the Clark Kent Superman phenomenon, in which somebody who is like relatively unknown, but is a very great person, a Nister as they call it, is discovered, and it turns out Clark Kent is really Superman. And then in one variation of the story, the people who are at the head of the Judaism or the institutions make way and say, since we discovered now that you're Superman, you take over. And a sudden transformation is made. And a person who doesn't have the right background, as we'd say today, in terms of coming from the right yichus and the right family and married the right girl and all the rest of it, suddenly becomes the head of a yeshiva or a Sanhedrin or some other big institution. This happens rarely in Judaism, as you can imagine. Usually, Shiva world, the rabbinical world, is a pretty closed system. They strive for that anyway. So, for example, I could just think right off the top of my head, I could think of four famous cases. One is Hillel and the Bnei Becerra that many of you are probably familiar with in the Gemara in Pesachim, where way back in the time of Hillel, the people in charge of the Sanhedrin was the Bnei Becerra, and a famous question arose. What do you do when Pesach is in such a nature that the Seder is on Saturday night, which means you have to shecht the Karban Pesach on Shabbos itself, and are you allowed to do that? And without going through all the details, the famous story is the Bnei Becerra did not know the answer, even though they were heads of the yeshiva, and this fairly obscure person called Hillel HaBavli knew the answer. And then the Bnei Becerra said, I guess, wow, you're so smart, you know the answer. We quit, you take over, and you be the head of the Sanhedrin, you be the Nasi. And that happened, of course, and that's how Hillel became famous as Hillel. This is very unusual. that a Rosh Yeshiva, because somebody else is, knows something he doesn't know, says, I quit being the head of the yeshiva and you take over. That's why it's mentioned in the Gemara. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who was a descendant of Hillel many centuries later, said, I can do a lot of righteous things, but I couldn't do what the B'nai B'Seira did. If somebody came to me and knew something I didn't know, I couldn't just simply say, I quit, I vacate my position, and you take over. So that was most unusual. A variation of this, or a similar incident that comes to mind, is 1,000 years later or so, when you have the story of the famous four captives, the famous tale in which four rabbis, big rabbis, were on a ship in the Mediterranean in the 10th century, and the ship was captured by Muslim pirates, or privateers, I should say. And at that time, piracy was a business, still is. And the bottom line is all the passengers that are taken captive on the ship are divided into two categories, those who will fetch a ransom and those who will not. And if you won't, then you're thrown overboard. But if you will, then they keep you till they get somewhere where they can sell you, make some money on you. And Jews, having a very strong tradition, as we know, of Pidyon Shvuyim, it's like a fundamental in our religion. So these Jews, once upon a time, had Pidyon Shvuyim committees in every town, especially in the ports in the Mediterranean. And the story is told that these four rabbis were taken captive, and the captors did not necessarily know who they were. You know, probably look like old men or something like that. And they're all captured torn, the clothes were torn. And as the pirate ships landed in different ports in the Mediterranean, local committees bought them off one by one. In other words, they landed at Chveis in Alexandria, and the Pidyon Shvuyim committee had enough money to pay for one captive, so one rabbi was redeemed and freed there. And another one, I remember, was in Tunisia, in Karawan. And a third one, I think we don't know where he was. And the fourth one is the most famous story, the fourth rabbi, because it was Moshe ben Chanoch. He's a big Talmud Chacham. But again, he looked like a piece of junk with his, having been beaten up and torn in in rags. And his wife had jumped over the ship. So with the father and the son, they didn't look anything special. And when the pirates, or the privateers, came back to Spain at that time, the Caliphate of Cordoba, and they came to the Jewish community there, meaning when the pirate ship sailed from the Mediterranean straight up the Guadalquivir River to Cordoba, which is the capital city of the country, the Pidyon Shvuyim committee there ransomed this guy off, him and his son, and not for a lot of money, just looked like some Joe Schmo, as they say. And the famous story is that he went to the shul, and just the same thing happens to Hillel and B'nai B'Seira. The local rabbi was giving a shiur, and somebody asked a question in the Gemara, and the rabbi couldn't answer it, and this stranger sitting in the back in rags said, I know the answer, and he gave the answer and explained the Gemara, and then the rabbi said, wow, you're much bigger Talmud Chacham than I am. I quit, you become the head. And that's how Rav Moshe ben Chanoch became the head of the yeshiva in Cordoba and founded the Sephardic glorious tradition of Torah scholarship. Same idea. He didn't look like much, but then when they discovered who he is, then it became a big deal. A third story pops to mind. That's the Baal Shem Tov himself. It's a very famous, very classic part of the Baal Shem Tov story. True or not, whatever, is that the Baal Shem Tov was, again, not from the right family. He was a little guy, but secretly he was a superman, and he knew all the Kabbalah and the Nigla and the Nistar, particularly the Kabbalistic stuff, but he hid it, and therefore he was only a nursery school assistant, and he liked it that way until one day a big Talmud Chacham was passing through town, and he kind of looked at him, and he didn't act like a regular dumbbell, and he stalked him and finally discovered him at night secretly doing Kabbalah, and he kind of outed him. And there's a whole long story that's connected with that, which I'll skip over for now. And the fourth story that comes to mind is of our hero today, the Rosh Hash, Shalom Sharabi, who's Yahrzeit today, because the story is, anyway, that he was a Yemenite Jew. So we're not dealing with Ashkenaz or Sephardi, we're dealing with Taman, Yemen, which is far away at the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula. And he lived in the 1700s, I believe 1720 to 1777. So he wasn't that old when he died. And being in Yemen, that was a very strong Jewish community. Most of us don't know much about the Yemenite Jewry, but they, even though they were far away from everybody else, they were like a very stark community in terms of Torah and Yiddishkeit and all that sort of thing. And famous story goes, that he was a young man and from Guy, obviously, and he must have been having a natural aptitude for Nigla and Nistor at a very young age. I don't know exactly. But the famous story goes that he was selling perfume and ladies, types of cosmetics as a profession. That's what a lot of Yemenite Jews were into, that sort of thing. And he had different customers, and an Arab lady took a look at him, and she tried to hit on him like Aishas Potiphar hit on Yosef, because he must have been handsome. And there's a whole long story that he basically jumped out a window or jumped out a bathroom window to escape getting involved with her and ran away. And then he realized he can't stay in the country because this is not good. It's her word against his, and no good is going to come out of this. It's like a black man in the South 100 years ago. There's no way it's going to come out good for you. And so as a result of this incident, even though he lived in Yemen, in fact, he's Sharabi, so that means in Sharab, in the part of Yemen that's near the Red Sea, he started walking, and he wanted to leave and go to Israel. Now, how do you go to Israel in the 18th century? Well, you say it's easy. If you look at the map, you just walk north from Yemen through Saudi Arabia to the Negev, and then next thing you know, you're in Israel. Easier said than done. In Islam, once Muhammad died, no Jew was allowed to ever step foot in Arabia. And if they did, they'd be killed or tortured worse. And that's the way it was, and that's the way it is today. As a matter of fact, all the 9/11 business that we have now, all the jihadists and the terrorists and Osama bin Laden, was because they got ticked off because in the war against Iraq, George Bush Sr. put, like, I don't know, 500,000 Christians and non-Muslim troops in Arabia, and that really violated that rule and really ticked them off, as we know. So if you wanted to go to Israel, and you really wanted to go to Israel from Yemen at that time, you had to go the long route. This is Parshas V'shalach. It's like it says, and therefore, that instead of going to Israel straight, you had to go in a big roundabout route. And so he had to walk, imagine this, from Yemen to Aden, which is the next country over in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, and then get a boat from Aden up the Persian Gulf to southern Iraq, Basra, and then travel from there to Baghdad, and eventually get a caravan from Baghdad to Syria, and then eventually from Syria to Israel, to Eretz Israel, to Yerushalayim. So, I mean, only somebody that's super dedicated would do a thing like I just described, and that's what he did. And he had all these adventures along the way, all of them involving, as they say, Clark Kent and Superman. Wherever he comes, he looks like a nothing and a nobody, but then once he starts participating in the conversations in the yeshiva in Baghdad and I think Damascus, they say, oh, he's a big deal. And eventually he reaches Yerushalayim. And again, he's very learned already by now in the Kabbalah stuff. This is the age of the Kisvei Arizal, as they call it, when the main part of Kabbalah was the traditions left over by the Ari, who died in 1572, I think. And he didn't write anything. And everybody's wondering, what exactly did he teach? Because everybody said he's like a Navi, had revelations from heaven about the nature of God and the nature of the universe. Very heavy Kabbalistic stuff. And all Kabbalah since his time is Arizal stuff. And very few people understood it and knew it, even today. And without going into too much details, only a few people were able to have the head and the ability to penetrate into this kind of world. And our hero, Sholem Sharabi, who's really, I think his name was Mizrahi. They call him Sharabi because he's Sharab. And he reaches Jerusalem, and he goes to this yeshiva, you might say a very small kollel that had very recently restarted called Beit El by a big Sephardi rabbi, Chayun, who was a mekubel. And what I mean by that is they studied the Kisvei Ari, and which was manuscript form, actually, in that time. And they tried to penetrate its meanings. And he says, he's a very nice person, apparently, and he approaches him and says, I would like just to be a janitor, a shamus. I'm looking for a job, and I'll take any menial job you want, and I don't even need his salary. Just, you know, give me room and board. And he made a good impression, the story goes, on the head of the institution, and said he took him to be the janitor, sweep the floors, clean everything up, I think wake the members of the group up for tikkun leil chatzos. You know, at nighttime they do that. And all sorts of help them in the mikvah, bring them tea, bring them coffee, whatever. All these menial jobs. And he's Clark Kent. And as far as they know, he's just a nice guy, but he's no player. He doesn't understand the discussions that are going on in the base matters. Of course, you and I know that he does. And really, he's Superman. And so the result is that time went by, and he was just, you know, always pretending to be dumb, but he's listening in. And you can imagine the story based on the trope that I just told you. One day, the Rosh Hashiva, the head of the Kollel, Rav Chayun, says, today we're going to learn this and this part in the Kisvei Ari. And as they go into it, he says, I myself don't understand it, and there are kashas on it, and it's too difficult for me to fathom. Does anybody have an idea what's going on? And nobody does, of course, except you and I know the janitor does. So he doesn't want to let on that he knows. And so the story is that at night, when nobody's looking, he writes down, he sneaks into base medicine when no one's there, and he writes down the answer, and he puts it in the book. So the next day, when the Rosh Kollel opens the sefer to where they were yesterday, magically, there's a petek, there's a piece of paper explaining the kash and the teretz in an amazing way, and he's like blown away. What happened over here? Is this Eliyahu HaNavi? And it happens two or three times, and the whole place is going nuts because nobody knows who did it. He asks everyone, did you do it? Did you do it? And nobody did it. And he's going crazy. Obviously, it never occurred to him that the janitor did it. And the story is that the Rosh Hashiva's daughter, the Rosh Kollel's daughter, got suspicious and she spied. She stayed over all night or something like that to see who's sneaking in the base medrash. And of course, she catches our hero coming in because he did this on a number of times later on also, that he wrote down on the piece of paper the answer. And then he hid it, said nobody should know. And she sees him and she tells the father, and the father calls in the janitor and he says, what's the story? Did you write this? And he said, I don't want to say. And he says, I order you to say who you are. And then he says, yes, it was me, but please don't tell anybody. And the father then says, that doesn't work anymore. If Hashem made it that this incident happened, that's a sign that you're supposed to come out of the closet. That's a sign that you're supposed to reveal yourself as Superman. And as a result, he had no choice, the story goes, and he became, you know, he came out of the closet, they all saw who he was, and naturally, as this, you would imagine the story, he marries the Rosh Hashiva's daughter, and when the Rosh Hashiva dies 2, 3, 4 years later, he becomes the head of the Beit El Kabbalistic Kollel, Yerushalayim, which is still there today, and he emerges as a big person in understanding Kisvei Arizal, and in many places in the world, the proper way to understand the technical parts of the Kisvei Ari, especially the davening, which is very important over there, you have to go through him. You have to follow the writings of Rosh Hashanah Rishash. And you probably don't know what I'm talking about. And Kabbalah, when you say Baruch Atah Hashem Elkeinu Melech Olam, you have to have Kavanas, meaning you have to say, when I say Baruch, I want my prayer to go this way in the Shemayim, in the heavens. And when I say Atah, I want a different direction. And, you know, Hashem and all the rest of it. There's a vast system of directed thoughts which make the prayers become much more powerful than they are when you and I say them. It's a basic element of Kabbalah. And he became the big expert in that. And he's therefore regarded as one of the great Mekubalim of all time. Of all time. So I think I've spoken more than I wanted to. If you're interested, you could go look it up yourself, because most of us are Ashkenazic Jews, and we're not so into the world of Sephardim. We ought to be, but we're not, and certainly not the world of Sephardic Mekubalim, and the Rosh Hashanah Rabbi is among the biggest of the biggest, and I have to go, so have a good day. Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.